This podcast has been brought to you by Panacea Healthcare Services, a trusted solution for your billing and collection needs.
Welcome to the Billing Advocates. This is a podcast that will talk about everything that supports medical billing efforts. We'll be discussing billing and collections, utilization review, credentialing, clinical documentation, and everything that supports the revenue growth for healthcare providers and physicians nationwide.
All right, so I think some introductions are in order. I'm Gian DaCosta, the Director of Operations here at Panacea Healthcare Services.
And I'm James Gordon, Managing Partner for Panacea Healthcare Services.
And I'm Jackie Sereno, Collections Manager here at Panacea Healthcare Services.
And I'm Jason Chacko, I'm the Billing Supervisor here at Panacea Healthcare Services.
Okay, thank you guys. We are back once again. Welcome to the Billing Advocates, you know, where we talk about everything concerning revenue cycle management and how to continue the efforts on getting paid, basically. We're going to touch on what we usually do as our current events. Pretty interesting topic Gian and I have come across. The Trump administration drafting a plan to allow U.S. consumers to import drugs from Canada. Interesting subject matter. What are you thinking about that there, Gian?
So I'm actually very excited about this again. Anything in healthcare where I feel like we're going for a more patient-driven approach, where patients and we're trying to lower their costs, I'm all about it. So essentially, from my understanding when I'm reading that article, the goal is to allow for importation of certain pharmaceuticals from Canada into the U.S. because Canada's pricing, I guess, is more competitive. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, there would still be import fees and costs, but because of their lower costs, it still will lower the overall cost for the patient here in America. And so that's very exciting because right now, as we've moved forward in the pharmaceutical industry, you'll have like antibiotics. You have some pharmacies, some retailers who will go ahead and actually provide those for free. So I just love that we're moving forward where healthcare just needs to become more and more accessible to everyone and more cost effective to everyone, because sometimes people can't afford that more effective version of a drug. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this really just opens that up so we have healthier and more financially stable people, because healthcare can truly break a home.
Now, I do agree. I think lower drug costs for those in need of those particular drugs are definitely crucial for the American public. I do think maybe one of the issues that, you know, as we're reading this particular article, is going to be consumer safety. You know, without FDA approvals, you have to kind of wonder, you know, what is the safety on these drugs? You know, are they really going to be tested and going to be something that's safe for the American consumer?
I'm going to assume that it's going to have to be things that are FDA approved. I'm hoping that that's the case. It would be very weird if they didn't do some kind of testing or approval or something, at least some preliminary, or at least maybe Canada's own version of FDA approval. Mm-hmm. That it has to go through their own process, and as long as they have their, you know, check on their side, will allow it to be sold here because it's good for their people. So that could definitely be a factor in there. And one thing that we have to kind of see is how insurance companies will react to it.
Yes.
You know, will they raise out of pocket for drugs? Will the copays change for drugs? Will they try to do more of a co-insurance situation rather than a copay? How will they break up? Because normally when you look at RX insurance, it breaks it up in drugs by tiers and then also generic versus brand. Mm-hmm. So I really just want to see how that changes in the future if drug prices do come down. Because unfortunately, you know, of course, those big multi-million dollar industries, they still try to find a way to continue to make what they're currently making or more. So I really hope this is going to find a way to bring that cost down for the patient, but still find a balance.
I certainly agree. And though I notice it's not mentioned in this article at all, maybe that stigma is still at a high level, but I wonder from a medicated assisted treatment, which is pretty much on the rise in behavioral healthcare services, those particular drugs, we know they come at a particular high cost, and I wonder if that's also going to be an opportunity for Canada to be able to participate in Medicaid-assisted drugs such as naltrexone, Vivitrol, and maybe similarities to those particular drugs, and could allow those costs to go down as well for those clients in those particular needs.
And then on that note, I know that there are other things that people do in other countries for substance abuse or Medicaid-assisted treatment. We actually spoke to somebody. You remember, James, we had that call with a potential, and they worked out of, I want to say...
Bahamas.
Yes. And yeah. They had a very unique way that they did Medicaid-assisted treatment, but it wasn't FDA approved yet, so they couldn't do it in the States, and they were still going through that whole process.
Yeah, I recall.
But, you know, not necessarily Canada. They may have their own that they have, but it could really revolutionize different industries if there are drugs that we don't have access to now or different healthcare methods that we don't have access to now. And maybe this will also open up to other countries and, you know, be able to really share and learn from each other.
I do agree. I think at the end of the day, a mandate like this is necessary. Lower drug costs, as long as it's not going to jeopardize consumer safety, I think is in the best interest for the American people. Another good article for us. And now I think it's time to get into the meat and potatoes of the subject today.
All right, guys, go ahead and get your dipping sauce ready. Today we're going to drop a fresh nugget on billed versus allowed. What's really the recommended billed amount for behavioral health providers? All right, guys, welcome back to our meat and potatoes segment. I'm joined with Jackie, Jason, and James. And today we will be discussing bill charges versus allowed amounts.
Ooh, testy subject.
You got that right.
And so first, I just want to give a definition to what these things are, just in case somebody doesn't know. The bill charge is essentially whatever you determine the rate in which you intend to bill for a service. So say you'd say detox, you're going to bill $5,000, $2,000, whatever the provider determines their bill charge amount. No one can really make a difference in what you determine your bill charge to be. And then the allowed amount is actually going to be the insurance's allowance for the service that you're providing. So it's going to be determined by that patient's policy, that particular insurance. It's going to fluctuate. So Blue Cross is actually, unfortunately, for an out-of-network provider and even sometimes in-network provider, have different allowed amounts for the same service being rendered for different tiered policies, because you have to also bear in mind that patients pay for different tier policies. And so if I'm paying more money, my policy more than likely should be covering more, where I may have a less copay or I have a lower coinsurance, so my insurance is going to pay more. Different things and different factors come into play when you're looking at the insurance's actual allowed amount.
Awesome.
I always found, you know, that based on this fact, which exists with all patients as far as their allowed amounts, why do providers feel the necessary need to raise their billed amount, knowing pretty much customarily it most likely will go against what the allowed amount is?
I don't think they want to pay attention to that at all. They just think that the higher we bill, the more money we'll obtain or will be reimbursed. They don't take into consideration that Blue Cross, for example, it could be based on the alpha prefix. So you might have a policy that comes from the state of Washington that reimburses lovely, and then again have one in the state of Florida that reimburses pennies.
Yeah, pretty much.
But you know, like, I understand where the mindset comes from. It's the needing to change that mindset, because years ago, like, and I know you probably definitely know this, like, especially in the laboratory world, a lot of times, let's say 2 years ago, insurances were paying a percent of bill charges.
Absolutely.
Rather than what's happening now, where everyone's like, well, we're going to go by a percentage of Medicare. A lot of, ever since, I want to say, Blue Cross started doing it first in certain states, and then slowly the other major carriers like United Healthcare, especially with the enactment of Obamacare, they all started incorporating different policies where they're going at different percentages and different rates of the Medicare, or they'll look at what they pay in network and maybe pay a little above that. They've really just factored in a lot of different things. And so the mindset needs to change. What you were doing before, where I'm going to bill out $2 million for the month and I know I should be getting 60, 85%, whatever your percentage used to be.
Exactly.
It's not that case anymore.
No, definitely absolutely not. We just had a... Sorry, not to cut you off. But I just had a case where we put in our claims. They processed and paid. A couple of them paid really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
Then it came back when I wanted the methodology of it. They're telling me it's going to pay at 105% of the Medicare allowable. Of course, you have to find out what that allowable. Medicare allowable is for there. But we got paid, say, $3,200 on a $4,000 claim. yet they broke it down, and now we're getting $750 on that same $4,000 plan.
Wow. And then you remember the other issue that we had last week, where allowed amounts also vary based on your location and then also the location where that policy comes
yes,
from.
Yes, absolutely.
So we had a case last week yes. where initially the Blue Cross in the New York area, when they initially paid it, they priced it as if they were going to pay a provider in their tri-state area. And so they priced and paid, like, I want to say it was $4,000
yeah,
a day.
I think
like,
it was
like a ridiculous high amount. Like, they paid almost the full bill amount. They realized what they did because the provider's actually in on the West Coast. They realized what happened, and so they went ahead and voided the payment that they made to the provider and said, oh, no, you need to submit new claims again. And when they started reprocessing and paying those new claims, they were paying less than $500 for the very same service, the very same codes, the very same everything. But because they weren't in that same tri-state area, they allowed a different amount.
Wow.
Right.
I think the debate on how we should set our rates when it comes to out-of-network facilities has been going on since the beginning of facilities. And the way I look at it is you really have to look at how you're doing your accounting. So mm-hmm. let's say the facilities that I bill for, let's say for partial hospitalization, I would give a rate range of between $1,800 to $2,400. And that's basically based on just facilities that we bill for in demographic areas.
That's for substance abuse and mental health?
Substance abuse and mental health, gotcha. Yeah. Now, the facility is going to go ahead and choose a rate, you know, that they feel is fair, you know, within that range, and go ahead and we bill out the charges. And I think what's important is the facility not to expect in their accounting or expected revenues that full $2,400, let's say.
Exactly.
And put that into their books as expected revenue, because that's not going to be the case 99% of the time.
Trust me, we're going to try our hardest to try to collect all that money. Now, I will tell you that, but
one thing I feel like providers don't consider, because I get what you're saying, Jason, and I agree with it, listen to your peers and be average with your peers, but not everyone is conscious of that, and not everyone is thinking of the flip side. If you decide to, you know, charge $2,400 for your PHP, and for those policies where they only paid $500, $600, $700, bearing in mind, if that's all they allowed, everything in between the billed amount and the allowed amount becomes patient responsibility. So that $1,600, the patient actually owes you that money. And based on certain insurances, laws like Cigna is one that is a huge stickler for this. They need to see that you're balanced billing and attempting to collect
Absolutely.
That balance from the patient. So you try to collect $1,600 a day for PHP for those patients, who's going to pay that? You know, not these people are not people who have those funds. Of course, you'll run into some that do, that you can get on payment plans. But it really puts you in a whole different other position where sometimes you need to also think about the patient. So my recommendation personally is always to take a look at your averages. Where are you averagely being reimbursed for these services? And then adjust your bill charge there and then see if your average changes too much, because you still need to consider if a patient can actually pay you the balances that are left over after the allowed amount.
That's true.
And then going back from an accounting perspective, as Jason was saying, I think what happens, you know, with some of even our clients at Panacea is now you have you're disillusioned with what the aging looks like. You know, you're looking at an aging that you consider and your internal facilities team is considering to be a $5 million aging. But that's based on the billed amounts that you've dictated.
Absolutely.
Whereas from an allowed amount perspective, it's probably a 1.2 on the books, $1.2 million on the books.
I've seen it cut. Agings in more than half.
Right.
Yeah. And I think what that creates is confusion from an internal perspective and unrealistic pressure put on the billing company, no matter who that company is.
Right.
You know? So another aspect to think about is that we're talking about out-of-network this whole time. For an in-network provider, what is the difference between their billed amount and their allowed amount? And so there is a debate, and what I always say with this portion of things is whoever you utilize for compliance, who does their compliance with the state to make sure you're compliant with their guidelines in determining your bill charge. Because when you're in network, you have your set allowed amount. You know every time I bill for this service how much I will be paid. So you could, for those insurances in which you're in network, set your rate to your bill, your contracted rate, so that way when you bill, what is billed is allowed. the only catch is I've heard in that certain states, you can't do that. They don't want you to have varying charges, or they want you to have transparency in what you're charging. But you could publish your out-of-network rate, and you could also publish your in-network rates that you're charging the various insurance carriers. But what I say to that is always check with someone as far as compliance, so you're compliant with your state's laws to make sure that you can do that. But it makes a difference between a provider who's in-network and out-of-network. Sometimes the insurances see these high charges that it doesn't even matter. The patient's not responsible for the difference. You're just looking at an inflated aging for absolutely no reason. There's no added benefit to you for it.
And then I believe Gian mentioned one thing I just want to touch on is, you know, if a provider is choosing to go with a billed amount that is higher than normal, expecting only the allowed amount to reach their goal, I don't think is realistic. They need to go after the patient responsibility. Because when you combine that, it can maybe help to reach your billed amount goal closer. But going only for the allowed amount payment and not going after the patient responsibility will definitely cut that opportunity even shorter.
And I just want to say for our behavioral health providers, because I know that's what we're talking about, I just want them to know this is like an insurance-wide issue for the hospitals that we work with. This is the same scenario when they're working with emergency room services, yeah, where the prices for the different hospitals that we work with are crazy different.
Wow.
And sometimes they're just expecting this huge lump sum back for an emergency room stay, and they're rudely awakened, let me say, when they see what the insurance actually allows, yeah, when they're out of network, whereas, you know, our in-network ones, of course, they know what they're going to be getting for that service.
Got you. And just for clarity for our listeners out there, is the allowed amount versus billed amount issue, does that exist only for commercial payers, or does that exist from an aspect of governmental payers as well?
Well, for governmental payers, it's going to be what it is. So
gotcha.
They're just going to reaper. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's always a fee schedule, no matter where you are.
And they don't even want to see you charge outside that fee schedule.
Gotcha. Just wanted to establish that so we could know the difference between the commercial payer conundrum going on, but what is just pretty much black and white from a governmental payment, yeah, perspective.
In a lot of cases, you can't even bill your bill charge. It could reject, like the client that we have that utilizes Medicaid. A lot of them, their internal systems are just legitimately set up only to accept something recognized by their, mm-hmm, fee schedule. So that charge, even being a penny,
right,
off, could kick it back, and then you're not even, that bill isn't even on file.
Yep.
So
yeah,
you think that you're doing something,
it,
you're doing nothing. Mm-hmm.
AKA the governmental payers are not trying to hear that.
Exactly.
Definitely not.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining us for the meat and potato segment of today's show. And we'll see you next week.
I do say, I believe from a behavioral healthcare perspective, it might be some questions a lot of providers listening right now may have on that billed amount versus allowed amount. Want to continue the conversation? Please reach out to us. We would love to be able to talk with you and answer any questions that you may have. Okay, now it's time for our mailbag segment. This is where we take questions from our listeners and be able to use our expertise in providing solutions.
So for today's question, guys, we have, how does the recruitment process work, and what do we do to determine if it's valid?
Mm.
Do you want to take the first bite out of this one, Jackie?
I sure will. Basically, the recruitment process goes like this. You receive either a refund request from the insurance carrier advising, hey, we paid such and such amount of money, we shouldn't have, and we want you to pay us this money back. So our process is, we absolutely want to find out if what they're saying is correct. Did we even receive this money that they're saying that we received? So we're going to have to do some research and double check. Did we get the money? If we did, is it a valid refund request? Should we pay this money back? Depending on the circumstances. And then we have to do the legwork.
What would you say is like the most common recruitment reason?
Overpayment. They try to come back with the overpayment, saying they overpaid a claim, and we fight back, and sometimes we appeal that type of decision, because what is your methodology to tell, mm-hmm, me that you overpaid my claim, unless it's an obvious one and say they paid 100% on one claim and the rest they were consistent in paying,
so then clearly that one's overpaid. And then, of course, you have, like, the ones for policy terminated, different coverage Absolutely. And actual benefit issues. And we just dig into those and work with the insurance to determine what the true benefit information is.
Absolutely.
And then turn it around if need be. One of the things I wanted to touch on that I first thought of with this question that we get is, do the insurance companies take the money automatically, as in are they going to offset from your future payments, or do you have to write a physical check? And so I know we've discussed this in the past, and normally it's that it's really to the insurance's discretion.
I've seen both.
Exactly, where they basically they'll just keep telling you about the recoupment, and then they'll write in the letter to tell you that you need to send that check, or they should tell you that they're going to offset from future payments, at which that point we do track that.
Absolutely. We've seen many bulk checks come from insurance carriers a little short, and those are the reasons why.
Absolutely. Or they call and harass me. That happens.
And so there are cases where they do an offset and say we're still like in the process of trying to appeal the decision, and then say they've already gone ahead, they recouped it for whatever reason, but you were able to overturn that decision. And so Jason, from the billing perspective, what happens is that we have to rebill that claim for whatever reason, whether we have to correct something, say they say that the mental health should have been primary versus the substance abuse.
Yes, that's a big one too.
You know, and so we have to go ahead and refile that claim. What does that look like from the billing perspective of having to refile that claim?
Well, basically from the billing perspective, whenever I get recoupment or something along those lines, I always try to determine, is it a valid recoupment first? So I go in and I investigate with, the collections team, and I see what exactly is the insurance saying that we did wrong or was wrong with the claim, research it and find out if it's valid. And I always tell providers, document everything that goes on with the patient. And it could be something that we can use later on as evidence. So just because, you have a valid recoupment doesn't mean you can't fight that recoupment. So I always suggest, if there's any documentation that you have that can say, hey, this is why we did what we did, we can send that in, with the letter to the insurance companies. Now, if they go ahead and still uphold that recoupment, that's at that point we would need to see if we can fix what they were looking for on the actual claims. So we would actually go in and take the original claims and just really rebuild them to the standards that the insurance company is saying that was incorrect or different.
Like a corrected claim, like that diagnosis
It would be a corrected claim, yeah. And we would definitely follow up with the insurance and let them know, hey, we got your recoupment. We went ahead and rebuild it, the way that you needed it. And just letting them know that it's in process. And then, that's how we are dealing with the recoupment.
And let me ask for providers out there who are curious, is there a particular time that is going to be allowed to actually fight those recoupments?
That's dependent upon the carrier. Sometimes we have some payers that say, hey, you better respond within this amount of time. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we're going to consider it valid. Really, they can't do that because I've dealt with those before and nowhere. And I do my due diligence. When I research something that you're telling me, mm-hmm. I'll go on case law studies for different states and make sure. And if I need to, I'll quote their own statute. Compliance. Correct. Absolutely.
And then I think it also matters the dollar amount they're trying to recoup.
Yes.
Because when they're coming for like a bulk amount, like say they wanted to do a post-payment review for medical necessity, what can happen is they'll send that request out for records, and then for whatever reason, say the facility didn't respond or didn't communicate with us, or, if they're working independently, they just didn't send anything in. And now they go ahead and send you a recoupment letter for like $60,000 for these patients that they never received information from. They're going to come a little more aggressive, of course, because this is a bulk amount that they're trying to then take back. So it definitely does make a difference in the dollar amount as well.
Absolutely. And to go back what Jason was saying, documentation is super, super important because a lot of times after a post-payment review, which is the insurance carrier had paid already on the claim, and all of a sudden they have maybe two claims left to pay, and they said, hold on, I want all the medical records for this patient. So here we go. We have to pull the medical records. They're entitled to it, regardless mm-hmm. that you have authorization and all the information that's required. You submit those medical records, and now they come back and they say, hold on, we paid, but they weren't, they didn't actually meet the criteria needed, and now bang, he has this huge recoupment amount, again, yeah, back to what Gian's saying, of $60,000, $70,000.
And on that note, what Jackie said right there also is very key in documentation. Keep all your facts, your fax confirmations, keep all your tracking. Do not send anything without tracking or fax confirmation, because you will be beat when they come to you about the timeliness of submitting something, because the insurance company is great for losing your documents, saying you never sent anything in, or it went to somebody in some department.
Oh, yeah.
It was in the back of my file, so I just didn't see it.
Can you fax it again, please?
Yeah. Can you fax it again? Or actually, I'm sorry, we can't consider it if you don't have any confirmation.
Yep.
Thank you guys for joining us for the mailbag segment.
And we hope you learned something. Week. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Billing Advocates. We really appreciate your time.
If you have any questions or suggestions about this episode or future episodes,
or if you want to be featured in the mailbag segment, please do not hesitate to contact us via our email, info@fromyourbillingadvocates.com.
And remember, no matter how large the problem, we're always ready to snap a cape on.
Dun-da-da-dun! The Billing Advocates.